Right, apologies for the three attempts that I made to have this second lecture, all of which were thwarted by Scott Rail on the whole. Although I guess I could really also blame the Indian consulate, because that's why I had to go through to Edinburgh in the first place to get a visa, having failed to get my passport last Friday. That's why I was in fact here this week, and hence was at least able to reschedule the lecture for today. So what we've actually wound up with is maybe what would have made sense in the first place, which is one lecture per week. I mean, we try our best to do it that way, especially for more advanced courses, rather than throwing too much at you at once. My original itinerary was to be away all of this week, and that wouldn't have been possible. Anyways, here we are, and the other thing I realised after the first lecture was that I had distributed handouts, but I didn't collect the spares. Now, maybe there weren't any spares. Does everybody have a set? Sorry, Geoffrey. I'm afraid when I came back on the Monday, they'd all gone. The cleaners must have thrown them out. They're on the web already, but I say apologies for not being able to give you a hard copy set to look at. I can bring some extra hard copies next time, or you may just want to print them for yourself in the meantime. Okay? What I've put in the web so far is chapters 1, 2 and 3, which we'll really cover is for the first, certainly 4, possibly 5 lectures. So to recap, chapter 1 is just a review of what I kind of think you ought to know from GRG1, and it is a resume of the key ideas, but also a chance for me just to present those key physics ideas in the mathematical notation, which isn't wildly different from what Norman's used, but in some respects may appear different at first, because I've generally gone for coordinate notation rather than coordinate free notation. And what that essentially means is that the equations have got lots of indices, and it's to get you used to the idea of working with the equations in that form. But I didn't go through chapter 1 last time, because it really is just all a complete recap of ideas from the first half of the course. If anyone's got any questions about it, then don't hesitate to come and talk to me about them, or email them, or indeed email Norman. And what we'll do at the end of this semester before the degree exam is that we'll do a revision session, or multiple revision sessions, probably as a double act, because it's easier if we're kind of covering both halves of the course together. And we found that works quite well. Last time then, we did get a good way through chapter 2. And what that involved was looking at a particular type of model which makes Einstein's equations and all the various equations that follow from Einstein's equations a bit simpler. And those models are models which are static with spherical symmetry. There's all those famous jokes about, you know, physicists tackling any problem will consider the spherical solution first, you know, consider a spherical cow, those sorts of jokes. But at least fortunately in astrophysics, that approach is quite justified, because most stars are pretty spherical, and most of the solutions that we're going to look at in this course can be very well described by models with spherical symmetry. So we began by looking at orthogonal metrics. I took you through a little bit of the groundwork for what the main event today is, which is the derivation of the Schwarzschild metric. I emphasised just at the end of the last lecture that generally throughout this course we'll use units in which both the speed of light c and the gravitational constant g are set equal to 1, and I think that's about as far as I'd got, so that's what I'd like to pick it up from. We've got just a bit beyond that, spherically symmetric metrics. That's right, let me see if I can find where we had got to. Yeah, that's it. Case of a static space-time. I've just given you this equation, ds squared is minus e to the nu dt squared plus e to the lambda dr squared, and then the remaining parts. And I was asking you to consider that this equation here, if e to the nu and e to the lambda are both equal to 1, would just be Minkowski spacetime. It would just be the flat spacetime of special relativity. So e to the nu and e to the lambda in general will not be 1, but if you have a spherically symmetric static spacetime, then the coefficient of dt squared and the coefficient of dr squared are both going to be positive, and that's why we write them as e to the something, because the function e to the something is always positive for any value of the something. Our task today is to work out what e to the nu and e to the lambda actually are for the physical situation, which is a point mass with a static space-time around it. That's what we call the Schwarzschild metric. Now, many of you will have met the Schwarzschild metric before. Not all, but those who did astronomy too saw the equation for the Schwarzschild metric, but not where it came from. What we're going to do today is see where it comes from. Okay? Now, before we do that, just before we do that, what I want to do is take you through a couple of worked examples on the board, because the building blocks out of which we get the Schwarzschild metric are the components of what's called the Ricci tensor. The Ricci tensor is a 2-0 or a 1-1 or a 0-2 tensor, depending on which form it's written. It's of rank 2, and it's formed by contracting, by taking sums over certain components of the Riemann-Christoffel tensor, the one that describes the curvature of spacetime. The Ricci tensor is therefore built up from Christoffel symbols and their derivatives. And the Christoffel symbols, in turn, depend on the metric components and its derivatives. So it all is tied up with this idea that, you know, space-time tells matter how to move, matter tells space-time how to curve. The mathematical version of that is Einstein's equations, and Einstein's equations involve the Ricci tensor with some other stuff, which we call the Einstein tensor. So in deriving the Schwarzschild metric, we're going to need to know what the Christoffel symbols are for a spherically symmetric static space-time. And in fact, they're given up here, but I wanted to work through a couple of them just to let you see where all that comes from, and it will help you to, I hope, to get a picture of how we use the maths that gives us the physics that we're describing in these lectures. So let me try to do that. I've just jotted down a couple here that I wanted to work through as illustrations of how the others would go. The first thing I'm going to do is write down a general expression for the Christoffel symbols. So I'm denoting it by indices mu, nu and lambda, and they can all be different for the moment, but we'll think in a moment as to what restrictions we can place on them. So I've just said that that is related to the metric and its partial derivatives. So it's essentially telling you how the shape of spacetime is varying as you move around within the spacetime. More formally, it tells you how the basis vectors transform from one place to another. So say for Cartesian space, the basis vectors are the same everywhere, so the Christoffel symbols are zero everywhere. But if the basis vectors vary as you move around a curved spacetime, then the Christoffel symbols will be non-zero. And here is the expression that you'll have got in Norman's half. I'll just write it up on the board and then stand back and look and make sure that I've written it right, first of all, and then talk about what I've written. Okay, so what we have here is a sum of three terms, but those terms are themselves summed over because what we've got in front of the bracket is the metric components in contravariant form, that's with upper indices, mu and sigma, so the repetition of sigma between the term at the front and sigma appearing in each of the bracketed terms, that's the Einstein convention, Einstein's summation convention, telling you that you should be summing over a bunch of terms. However, the first simplification we can make is to note that if we're talking about an orthogonal metric, which we are, that means that the off-diagonal terms of the metric are all zero, then straight away that means that the summation over sigma is only going to matter. We only need to consider the term sigma equals mu. Because if sigma doesn't equal mu, then g mu sigma is going to be zero because it's an orthogonal metric. Okay? So we can straight away replace this expression by a new one, which is g mu mu over 2 times, and then the square bracket is basically the same, but with sigma replaced by mu, g lambda mu mu minus G nu lambda nu. Okay? Maybe I'll put the light on for this, it would help a wee bit. That's better. Can put it back off again when we're using the screen. Okay, so this is just to let you see that that one doesn't always follow, but the second line is true for an orthogonal metric. Okay? So that's the condition that has to be true in order for the second line to hold. And now, we'll translate that general expression where mu, nu and lambda can be symbols for any coordinate into the specific example we have here where we're using radial, well, spherical polar coordinates, which involves a radial coordinate, a theta and a phi, and of course we've got time. So among the various terms that we have to evaluate, we've got gamma of r t t. So mu is appearing kindly as r, and nu and lambda are both equal to t. They're both not equal to in the sense of like an exact equation, but they're both being represented by the label t. Okay? So just straightforwardly now translating what we have, it's g upper index rr over 2 into g sub r t comma t plus g r r comma t minus g t t comma r. Okay? But now we can use some other properties. We're talking about a static spherically symmetric space-time which has an orthogonal metric. So we've already used the fact that it's an orthogonal metric, but we've not used the fact yet that it's a static space-time. Now GRT, that component is going to be zero because it's orthogonal. But as a sort of double whammy, even if it weren't an orthogonal metric, if it's a static one, then the partial derivative of whatever that was with respect to t would still be zero. So it's zero anyway, but when we differentiate zero, you've still got zero. So that term vanishes, the first one in the square bracket. The same thing goes for the second term, grr. Well, that's one of the diagonal terms of the metric components. So for an orthogonal metric, grr isn't going to be zero, but it's not going to depend on time because it's a static metric. So that term vanishes as well. So all we're left with is the third term, grr over 2 times g sub rr comma t. Now if we've got an orthogonal metric, which effectively means for a 0-2 metric you can think of it as a 4x4 matrix, it's a diagonal matrix because there's no off-diagonal terms which are zero, which are non-zero, sorry. Therefore, the contravariant components of the metric are just 1 over the covariant component. So g with upper rr is just the same as 1 over g with lower rr. Okay? Well, at least for the space-like components, that's true. GTT, well, let's not go there. If you're working through these for yourself and you ever encounter a term that involves GTT, you've got to be... oh, I've written that wrongly. Ah, darn. It's always the case when you're up close to the board, you can never really see what you've written. If I stand back, I see that. So that's better. So it's GRR. I got that bit right at least. But the term that we're left with is GTT, R, and there should be a minus sign there. Okay? Right. But what I was just saying still stands, that G upper indices RR is just equal to 1 over GRR with lower indices. So we wind up with 2 GRR, and then on the top we've got GTT, R, and we've got a minus sign. Okay? Okay, so this all looks very abstract. Let's connect it now to what we have. We established that the static nature of the metric and the spherical symmetry of the metric allows us to write the metric in a particular form, equation 223. So GRR is equal to what? If you look at equation 223, to make sure that you know what I mean by GRR. E to the lambda, that's right. It's the term which is the coefficient of the dr squared term. Okay? And similarly, gtt is going to be minus e to the nu. Alright? So, the Christoffel symbols are just given by what we get when we work that out. So, we've got minus e to the nu, which we have to differentiate with respect to r. So, well, if you differentiate that with respect to r, you just get minus e to the nu again, but then you've also got to use the chain rule and differentiate nu with respect to r. And I've written that as nu dash, and then you're dividing that by 2, well, grr is just e to the lambda, as Jamie says, so that's, we can write the whole thing, the two minus signs cancel out, we get a half e to the nu minus lambda times nu dash. Alright? I know the notation's all weird, but it does really mean something. It's telling you how the basis vectors are changing with time, and how those basis vectors relate to the metric components. So essentially that's encoding information about how the curvature of space-time is different from zero. If it was equal to zero everywhere, then you'd just have the Minkowski metric in Cartesian coordinates, but we don't, and that's where the e to the nu's and the e to the lambdas come in. Okay, now we can go through very similar algebra for another example, which would be gamma theta theta r, and I'll just save a wee bit of time here. I won't write it all out, but skip a couple of lines. But we can write that as g upper index theta theta over 2 times g theta theta differentiated with respect to r plus g r theta differentiated with respect to theta minus g theta r differentiated with respect to theta. So the second and third term in the square brackets would cancel each other out anyway, because the metric is symmetrical. Whether or not it's orthogonal, even if gr theta is different from zero, gr theta is going to be the same as g theta r. It's really just a fancy way of saying that the distance in space-time between here and here is the same as the distance in space-time between here and here. You could imagine space-times where that wasn't the case, but we don't live in one. We live in a space-time where, you know, the space-time interval it takes you to go between two events is the same regardless of which way you go. So those two terms are going to cancel out anyway, but because it's an orthogonal space-time, then anything where the indices are different, like r and theta or r and t, is going to be zero anyway. So those two terms vanish. We're just left with the first term, g upper index theta theta. So that's equal to 1 over 2 g lower index theta theta times g theta theta differentiated with respect to r. Now, what's g theta theta? We've lost our equation again, but we'll go back to 223. Say this is, to coin a phrase, not rocket science, but just it's a useful way for me to check that I'm not talking in view complete nonsense. What would g theta theta be? Exactly. Differentiate that with respect to r, you get 2r. The 2's cancel, so you basically get 2r over 2r squared, which is 1 over r, which is what appears on the next page. Okay? Right. So that's just a couple of examples. There's plenty more. as you can see, there's lots of other coefficients, but they just all involve applying the same basic machinery to work out what they are. And that equips us with the means to compute the components of the Ricci tensor. But rest assured, you would not be asked to do that in an exam. There's quite a few examples in recent years where I've asked something to do with the Schwarzschild metric, but if I've required the derivation of the Schwarzschild metric, then I always give you the components of the Ricci tensor. I mean, you know, it's not terribly difficult, but it's the sort of thing that I think it's just a bit inhuman to ask people to do under exam conditions. I mean, I tried deriving, what was it again, we'll get to this right at the very end of the course, Friedman equation, you know, starting off from Einstein's equations, because I thought, right, well, maybe this will do as an exam question. It was several years ago, and I was flying back from somewhere, and it was about 3-hour flight, and I think it took me the whole flight to get it right. The person sitting beside me must have thought I was completely mad, you're just still scribbling all this nonsense on paper. And by the end of the flight, I thought, well, there's no way that I could fairly justify setting that as an exam question. If I can't get it right inside 3 hours, then it's a bit unrealistic to expect someone else to do it. I just kept always introducing extra minus signs or leaving minus signs out or whatever. So if you need the components of the Ricci tensor, they'll be given. So that's 226 to 229. If you want the practice, then on example sheet 1 from GR2, you're asked to derive them, but you will not get that in the exam. What you might get, though, is a derivation of the Schwarzschild metric. So that's what we need to do in the second half of today, to see how, armed with the components of the Ricci tensor, we can convince ourselves what e to the lambda and e to the nu are, and hence how it differs from Minkowski spacetime. Okay, so any questions so far? All right, I'll carry on. I'll put that wee light off though, because I don't think we're going to need the board too much. So, the Schwarzschild solution. This is where our first bit of physics really comes in now. Because it's a very simple bit of physics. The bit of physics is just to say that if you've got an isolated mass surrounded by nothing else, no other mass, then what we do is we expect that the components of the Ricci tensor exterior to that mass are all going to be zero, because we expect that if space-time, to, you know, coin the phrase again, tells matter how to move and matter tells space-time how to curve, if there's no other matter in your space-time apart from this one single isolated point mass at the centre, then space-time should just be flat. So the right-hand side of all the equations on the previous page, 226 to 229, are all set equal to zero. Okay? So, just give you one last look at them. We take these components of the Ricci tensor. Of course, those are only the diagonal components, but all the off-diagonal components are zero. And maybe we shouldn't be too surprised by that, because we're busy talking about orthogonal metrics all the time. Therefore, it's no surprise perhaps that the Ricci tensor turns out also to have this orthogonality property. There's no preferred direction, so there's no curvature. There's no preferred direction for the curvature. So if all the components are zero, then it means we can add two of them together and we're still going to have zero. In fact, we can add two of them together and multiply one of them by anything you like and you're still going to have zero. So that's what I'm doing in equation 230. I've taken the RTT component, multiplied it by e to the lambda minus nu. I've added it to RRR, which gets a bit hard to say at this time of the day. And it turns out that that all just equals nu dash plus lambda dash over R. And that in turn has to equal zero. Okay? Now I don't propose to go through all that in the board, but it's very important that you can check this for yourself. But you can maybe just kind of see it by staring at it, but if you feel better about these things by writing it down, then please do so. So you've got an e to the nu minus lambda on the RTT term, and then you don't have such a term on the RRR term. So the purpose of multiplying by e to the lambda minus nu is just to get rid of that e to the nu minus lambda. So convince yourself that equation 230 is correct. And if it is correct, then that in turn implies, if we multiply both sides by r, that nu plus lambda is a constant, because nu dash plus lambda dash equals zero, so nu plus lambda must be a constant, because we've just integrated both sides, okay? Now we want our description of the Schwarzschild metric to make sense when we're far away from the mass. The massive body causes a deviation from Minkowski space-time close to it, but we'd expect that the further away you get, the closer we'll get to Minkowski space-time. So consequently, that means as r tends to infinity, we want e to the nu to tend to 1, and e to the lambda to tend to 1. So just to remind you again why I should make that, the physical argument is what I just said. The mathematical argument is just that our metric takes this form, and we want the form of equation 223 to reduce to the Minkowski metric when r is large. So that means we need e to the nu to tend to 1 and e to the lambda to tend to 1. Then we've just got the Minkowski metric back. Okay? So we want e to the nu to tend to 1 as r tends to infinity. So that means we need nu to tend to 0. Similarly, lambda has to tend to 0. But nu plus lambda has to be constant. So whatever nu plus lambda is, as r tends to infinity, it's also the sum of nu plus lambda has to be the same value everywhere else, because it's constant. Therefore, the constant has to be zero. Okay? So if nu plus lambda is zero, then that means that e to the nu has to equal e to the minus lambda, because nu is just minus lambda. Okay? And that means that if we go back to our Ricci tensor components again, then say we take equation 228, because we've already kind of dealt with 226 and 227, we've added them together, so we've squeezed all the juice we can out of 226 and 227, what we need to do next is try to simplify one of the other two. Well, the other two are really the same equation, because r phi phi is just r theta theta multiplied by sine squared theta. So that's not going to help us. So what we do is we work with r theta theta. And instead of having lambda and nu both appearing in the equation, we use the fact that we now know that lambda equals minus nu to eliminate nu from equation 228. So what 228 reduces to then is 236. E to the minus lambda, 1 minus lambda dash times r has to all equal 1. Okay? So there's a lot of steps, but the individual steps one by one are not really all that hard. It's just kind of remembering how to put it together. And that, I suppose, is, you know, what you get an M.Sky degree for. If you look at the sort of intended learning outcomes for the M.Sky, you know, these are the kind of things that we put in, which are demonstrably at a higher level than for the BSc. So while I was at pains to stress that you wouldn't need to be able to derive the Ricci tensor components, it is quite commonly the case, if you look at the past paper questions, that I have asked you to derive the Schwarzschild metric and not really given you much of a hint as to how you do it. I kind of expect you to remember these steps and put the argument together on paper, extracting it from inside your head. Okay, so if we've got ourselves to 236, let's assume that we have, then where do we go next? Well, we can actually write 236 in the form of 237. And I admit it doesn't immediately jump out at you, but if you differentiate 237, you'll see that you get 236 back. So let's do that. So you can convince yourself where that comes from. If we take equation 237 and differentiate it with respect to r, d by dr of r e to the minus lambda Okay, so I'm just going to differentiate the left hand side, and what I get then by applying the chain rule is that the derivative of r is 1, so it's e to the minus lambda plus r times the derivative of e to the minus lambda. So in fact I'll get rid of my plus sign and put in a minus sign instead, e to the minus lambda, but we've still got to use the chain rule on lambda, so it's lambda dash we multiply all that by. Okay, so we can take out a factor of e to the minus lambda. It's 1 minus lambda dash times r, which is the same as the previous equation. Okay? Now the reason why I did that wee trick and I turned 236 into 237 is that it's quite useful to have a differential equation which says d by dr of something equals 1, because we can easily integrate that. D by dr of r times e to the minus lambda equals 1, so that implies that r e to the minus lambda is equal to r plus a constant. Okay? Or, if we differentiate, if we divide both sides by r, that gives us that e to the minus lambda, which remember equals e to the nu, because we'd earlier established by requiring that the metric reduced to Minkowski spacetime far away from our massive body, that lambda plus nu has to equal zero. E to the minus lambda is going to equal 1 plus whatever our constant is, and we'll just call it alpha for the moment, divided by r. So what we began with was an expression for a static spherically symmetric spacetime, where because we knew that the coefficient of dt squared and the coefficient of dr squared both had to be strictly negative and strictly positive respectively, we called them minus e to the nu and e to the lambda. We've now worked out that e to the nu is actually 1 plus alpha over r, okay, where alpha is a constant. So our only job really now is to work out what alpha is. So the way that we tackle this, just about time to do this to finish up for today, is that we again invoke the idea that if the gravitational field isn't too strong, then we should recover what Newtonian physics would tell us. And that's our guide as to what the value of alpha has to be. Because remember, it's just a constant. So that constant would work even if it was like a weak gravitational field. I mean, it might have a different value for a weak gravitational field. That'll be obvious when you see what alpha actually is. But the form of the equation, the 1 plus alpha over r, should be valid even for a weak gravitational field. So what is alpha? So what we do is we say that we're releasing a little test particle. So it's a particle that's got so little rest mass that it doesn't actually disturb the space-time metric, it just moves in the background space-time metric. So we suppose that you initially set it off from rest. So dxj by d tau is 0 for j equals 1, 2 and 3, because x1, x2 and x3 would be the spatial coordinates, tau is the proper time, and dx0 by d tau, been a long day, that is, in other words, dt by d tau, that isn't going to be 0, but the other three are. So if you look all the way back to equation 128, maybe I should just zoom back and make sure I've got the equation number right, but I think I have. I think I checked all these things before the start of the course. It should be the equation for a geodesic. Yeah. So the geodesic differential equation, in the form that you, I think you said last week that you got it from Norman, that's 126, that can also be written in the form of equation 128, where you're summing over alpha and beta. But the spatial components of dx alpha by d tau are all zero because we're letting our particle off from rest. So equation 128, which is a sum over alpha and beta, actually, the only term that's going to be non-zero is going to be when alpha is represented by t and beta is represented by t. In which case it's gtt times dt by d tau times dt by d tau, that has to equal minus 1. Okay, so we've used that fact now. How did that help us? I've used that sort of famous phrase, after some reduction, because what we've done there is we've used the fact that GTT, actually it's not that much reduction, so I'll just do it on the board. GTT is minus e to the nu. So what we've got is that minus e to the nu times dt by d tau times dt by d tau equals minus 1. Or, in other words, e to the nu times dt by d tau all squared is equal to 1. Or dt by d tau all squared is equal to e to the minus nu, which is the same as saying that dt by d tau is equal to e to the minus nu over 2. Okay, so the algebraic steps are not difficult one-to-one, but remembering them all and how to put them all together, well, that's the bit that's tricky perhaps. Okay, so that's where equation 241 comes from. Now the reason why we wanted such an equation is that we want to, remember the physics reason for doing this is that we want to work out what the constant alpha is by invoking the idea that for a weak gravitational field it should reduce to what Newtonian physics would tell you. The Newtonian physics says that particles obey an equation of motion. So in GR, the equations of motion which come from Newton's laws are replaced by the geodesic equation. So what we want to do is to try and get a geodesic equation and then say, well, what would this look like if the gravitational field was weak? It should just look like Newton's laws. What would that tell us the constant is? So that's where we're going with all of this. We've first of all got to get the geodesic equation. So the geodesic equation takes the form of equation 242. Again, there's a bit of algebra, kind of reading between the lines algebra to be done there. Let me write out the full geodesic equation again. Okay, so that's d2x lambda by d tau squared plus gamma lambda alpha beta dx alpha by d tau dx beta by d tau equals 0. But remember, we're setting off our particle from rest, so the only components of dx alpha by d tau which are non-zero is the first one, dt by d tau. So this sum over alpha and beta, just like we used a moment ago, reduces to be like only the tt term. And we're also going to just consider x lambda represented by r. We're just going to get the radial component because that's all we need. We only need to consider one component of the equation of motion and we'll work out what alpha is. So if we let x lambda be represented by r and we take the sum over alpha and beta and throw away everything except the tt term, then you get equation 242. Okay? So all of that has to equal 0. dt by d tau, we've got an expression for that. So we're kind of almost there. So let's put the pieces together. We showed, have I still left it on the board? I hope I did. See if I can find it. Yeah. Maybe I'll put the spotlights on. and make sure we've got everything we need. So on the left hand side, we've got two bits of the jigsaw that we need. We've got this equation, gtt times dt by d tau all squared equals minus 1, which led us to deduce that dt by d tau squared is equal to e to the minus nu. So we've got that. And then the geodesic differential equation, well, I haven't written it on the board, but you can see it on the screen. It's equation 242. So dt by d tau squared appears in that equation, so we can replace that by e to the minus nu. But then e to the minus nu also appears over here, because e to the minus nu is 1 plus alpha over r all to the power minus 1. So there's quite a bit of substitution to be done, and I'm going to leave you to have a crack at that. And if anyone, well, I'm realistic. I know that you might not really do it before the revision at the end of the year. If anyone has a crack at it in the next week or so, then I'll be delighted. And if you get stuck, then come and ask for help. But as we approach the exam, then you certainly want to make sure that you can see how to go from there to there. Now, this gamma RTT term, remember, I think I probably rubbed it off, or did I leave it up? See, we've got that there. So there was sort of method in my madness. The reason why I derived gamma RTT was partly just to illustrate how you do these things, how you work out what the components of the Christoffel symbols are. But the reason why we need the Christoffel symbols in this particular case is it's key to us determining what alpha is, because it allows us to express the geodesic differential equation for our test particle in a form which we can relate directly to what Newton's laws would say. And that's what we get in 243. So by substituting in what gamma RTT is, so we got it to be a half e to the nu minus lambda times nu dash. But nu minus lambda, e to the nu minus lambda, rather, we can simplify that, because, well, e to the nu is this thing, e to the minus lambda is that thing again, so it's the whole thing squared. There's a bit of simplification to get down to equation 243, but have a crack at it for yourself. And what you'll get is that d2r by d tau squared is equal to alpha over 2r squared. So we ask ourselves, how would that relate to what you'd expect for a weak gravitational field? So we're done with all this scary math now. It's just a matter of now thinking physically what we'd get. If you had a weak gravitational field, so you've got a test mass, d2r by dt squared would be the acceleration. We've just gone back to t, because in Newtonian gravity you don't have all this nonsense with proper time and coordinate time to worry about. That's only relativity that brings all that in. As far as Newton's concerned, it's just absolute time, it's just t. So we've gone from d2r by dtau squared to d2r by dt squared. So that's an acceleration, and Newton says that force equals mass times acceleration. He also says that force is gmm over r squared. Now remember, of course, the whole foundation of gr is that it's a kind of special thing that acceleration and gravity are equivalent. But in Newtonian physics, they just are the same, rather than there being a kind of deep reason for it. So the gravitational force equation, we just equate to what Newton's second law would say. You know, you do that all the time in other physics courses where you talk about gravity. So we've got what that equation basically is that acceleration, the gravitational acceleration, otherwise known as small g, is equal to minus gm over r squared. Okay? But gr has told us that d2r by d tau squared is equal to alpha over 2r squared. So that means that alpha has to equal 2 times m for the two to match up. In fact, that's me being very economical in my equations, because what I'm doing is I'm already setting g equal to 1. If you want to keep everything explicitly in, then alpha is minus 2g m over c squared. But we're not going to use it in that form in this course, because I'm too lazy and I just want to set g and c equal to 1 whenever I can. Okay, but you'll probably remember seeing that before, because that's essentially the expression for the Schwarzschild radius, the 2gm over c squared. So to emphasise what we've done, we've applied the idea that far away from the origin of our metric, we ought to get Minkowski spacetime back, and we've used the idea that for a weak gravitational field, we ought to get Newtonian gravity back. Both of those conditions allow us to derive the Schwarzschild metric in the form, well, there it is, equation 246. So instead of e to the nu and e to the lambda, we can now explicitly put in what those terms are. They're 1 minus 2m over r, and then the dr squared has got a 1 minus 2m over r on the bottom. Alright? So this is, you know, a big result. There's obviously lots more to come in the course, but really, in terms of the big bit of mathematics, this is probably it. Most of the rest is taking the Schwarzschild metric, taking aspects of the Schwarzschild metric, and seeing what observable astrophysical consequences there are. Until we get on to looking at the interior structure of stars, which will be about lecture 6, then we're really just going to spend the next 3 or 4 lectures working with this metric. We're not going to derive any more. So we'll pick up that story next time, but just before we end today, I want to just draw attention to a couple of things, actually throw some real numbers at you, some physical quantities. The Schwarzschild radius, as I said, is the quantity 2gm over c squared, or because I'm setting g and c equal to 1, it's just 2m in my units. And, well, let me just go back to the equation for a moment, rather than read the words on the screen but not have the equation in front of me. It's easier to do it the other way around, to have the equation in front of me but not the words. If we look at that equation, then we'll see that if r is less than 2m, then actually 1 minus 2m over r will be negative. And that violates one of the conditions that we set up the Schwarzschild metric with, or in fact that we set up a spherically symmetric static spacetime with. In setting up a spherically symmetric static spacetime, we said that the spacetime metric would take the form minus e to the nu times dt squared, where e to the nu was positive. Now that's absolutely fine as long as r is bigger than 2m, because then 1 minus 2m over r will be bigger than 0. But if r is less than 2m, then we're in trouble. Similarly, when we developed the general metric for a static spherically symmetric spacetime, we said that the coefficient of dr squared was e to the lambda, where e to the lambda was strictly positive. The reason, as I said earlier, why we made it e to the lambda is that it's a function that's got the nice property that whatever lambda is, e to the lambda is always positive. But now we've derived, using the appropriate physics, that e to the lambda is actually 1 over 1 minus 2m over r, which again is perfectly fine, provided r is bigger than 2m, because then it will be positive, just as e to the lambda has to be. But if r is less than 2m, then once again we're in trouble, because there isn't a number whose exponential is negative. So what that's telling us is that the metric is misbehaving when r is less than 2m. And that, of course, is a whole other story that we won't get to for about 6 or 7 lectures, but we'll return to that point when we look at black holes. Because inside the event horizon, we need to rethink what we mean by time and what we mean by space. Because in setting up the spherically symmetric static space-time, we've got what we call the signature of the metric, which is that the first term's negative, the dt squared, and the other three are positive. When you're inside the event horizon, that rule no longer applies. The time-like part can change sign, and the space-like part can change sign. And that's kind of why, goes a long way to explain why such weird things happen inside the event horizon of a black hole, but we'll come back to that. All we need to do for the moment is to reassure ourselves that provided r is bigger than 2m, as I've said just up here, then that weirdness of the Schwarzschild metric isn't a weirdness, because it does what it should do. The dt squared term's negative, well, it is with the minus sign, and the dr squared term is positive. And again, as most of you will already know, if you work out the Schwarzschild metric for a thing like a star, well, you get a very small number. For the Sun, the Schwarzschild radius is about 3 kilometres, whereas the actual radius of the Sun, oh, I'm rubbish at remembering these things, it's about 750,000 kilometres, I think. So, consequently, the physical size of the object is way bigger than its Schwarzschild radius, and we would need another metric to describe the interior structure of the star anyway, which we'll cover in Chapter 4. Okay? But if you were considering an object whose physical radius was comparable with its Schwarzschild radius, then weird stuff will happen, as we'll see in Chapter 5 on black holes. Maybe it's Chapter 6, I forget. Okay? So we'll stop at that point for today, and we'll proceed next time with the chapter on the Schwarzschild metric. Now that we've got it, we can see what it predicts. Thank you.